A suspect in custody today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. A Florida man is suspected of mailing explosive devices to prominent Democrats and CNN this week. President Trump has called for unity. This security expert says that's important because words matter.
I do think there's a certain amount of responsibility, not for the bomb attacks, but a certain responsibility for the tone by the leadership of this nation.
Also, the frontrunner in Brazil's presidential race is often compared to President Trump, and many Brazilians here are no fans of Trump.
They tell me that Trump is the devil, and then they turn around and they say, we're voting for Bolsonaro. And I say, the two people are very similar in the message and the ideology.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World.
I am pleased to inform you that law enforcement has apprehended the suspect and taken him into custody.
President Trump speaking at the White House this afternoon. He was referring to the man arrested this morning in Florida. He's connected to a series of explosive devices mailed to prominent Democrats and CNN this week. The president also vowed not to allow political violence in this country, a message that was echoed today by Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
This is a law and order administration. We will not tolerate such lawlessness, especially not political violence.
One key part of the ongoing investigation is how those explosive devices made their way, presumably by mail, to multiple locations around the country. Juliette Kayyem is a security analyst and former Department of Homeland Security official. I asked her how the process of screening mail for security threats works.
So it's going to depend on whether it's a domestic or a foreign letter or package. So you can imagine that we have much greater security over foreign packages coming in. But domestically, just given the millions that go through domestic postal services a day, there isn't a tremendous amount of screening. There is screening for biological detection. All the letters and packages basically just go through a screener. But that's about it. And in some ways, that's the best that you can do because that's how we live now. I mean, you know, if you said, oh, we have to test every electronic device, I mean, think about everything that is going through the mail, whether it's a phone charger, a toaster that you order on Amazon. So the U.S. Postal Service investigation team is often utilized as part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force to be able to sort of backtrack. Where did the letters come from? Is there evidence on the packages, hair, fingerprints, and things like that?
What constitutes a suspicious package?
A couple of things. Someone who wants to protect the package in a way that seems like overkill, too much tape, something written like fragile or, you know, do not throw or whatever it is. Excessive postage because the person does not want it to be mailed back. So they're ensuring that the thing gets delivered. Also, if the sender is a known sender, so a Target or Walmart, right? The post office is going to be familiar with what their packaging looks like. And so if there's a piece that does not look like what they're familiar with, they might pull it as well. But once again, given the magnitude of pieces that are going through the postal system, a lot of times investigations have to start after a certain piece is already known to have been a threat or to be illegal.
What are the vulnerabilities you see in the current screening process by the U.S. Postal Service?
The way I think most people who are in security think about it is how do you focus on what we call secure flow? And how do you get more safety and security into a system, but still allow flow? Meaning our postal system has to move. Right now, it would be almost impossible to increase security for domestic packages without an overlay that would slow up flow and therefore hurt our economy. So we have focused on two areas that might be bigger vulnerabilities. One is, of course, foreign mail, making sure that the stuff coming in from outside has greater security at this stage. And then, as we were talking about before, focusing on packages that visually look suspect.
What kind of political implications can this kind of event have? I mean, we're coming right up on the midterms. I'm thinking of Spain back in 2004, where bomb blasts there had a significant impact on their election.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because we shouldn't forget that there is an election 2 weeks away. The president in a tweet today mentioned those elections and not the investigation. And before we knew who the person was, right, there was a lot of speculation about what kind of person it is and whether they were galvanized by some of the language in the political space. Now that we know a little bit more, I think the politics will play into this. And I'm sort of unapologetic about that. I mean, I think there was a time in which a president's words mattered. And whether people like Donald Trump talking a certain way or whatever, the American public views him as their president. And people will hear things differently than even maybe he intended. And I do think there's a certain amount of responsibility, not for the bomb attacks, but a certain responsibility for the tone by the leadership of this nation. When you take a step back of what someone tried to do, whether they were real bombs or not, the cast of characters is essentially the leadership of the opposition party. Just think about it. Two former presidents, former secretary of state, former first lady, their families. I mean, the Obamas still have a child in the home. I am of the view that this was a big deal because I do think it combined a lot of really bad atmospherics in our country right now. The idea of how we talk and vilifying enemies and targeting certain individuals all matter.
Security analyst Juliette Kayyem, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For months now, a debate has been simmering in Silicon Valley. Should private companies be entering into lucrative contracts with the federal government that help the Trump administration build tools for use in areas like immigration and defense? That debate is alive and well at Amazon. This week, the Daily Beast reported that the company is trying to woo ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, into using Amazon's controversial facial recognition technology. Andrew Peterson is with the nonprofit Project on Government Oversight and co-reported the story. She told us emails she obtained show Amazon and ICE started discussing this over the summer. Though it's not clear if and when this facial recognition software would be deployed by the agency, I asked Peterson what we know about how that would work.
So basically, facial recognition technology is when you have an algorithm set up that can match pictures with other pictures in a really automated, super fast speed. So much faster than like if you or I were looking at a picture and we're like, oh, yep, that matches that one, that matches that one. These are the same person. And what's concerning to civil liberties advocates and even some former ICE officials is that Amazon is promoting a technology that's capable of doing that, but using it in real time. So real time facial recognition, which means they could set up like a video camera across a crowd and scan it as people go past and say, oh, is this one of the people that we're looking for?
So do we know that ICE has used facial recognition technology in that manner?
We don't know that at this point, and we are actively investigating to try and find out more about how the agency is interested in using this kind of technology. But at this point, they've been very tight-lipped.
Now, you mentioned immigrant rights and privacy advocates are worried about ICE using this technology. Why?
Immigrants' rights groups and civil liberties advocates are worried about ICE using this technology for a number of reasons. And I do want to say it's not just limited to those groups. In fact, for our story, we spoke to a number of former ICE officials, including Alonzo Pena, a former deputy director at the agency, who expressed real concern that what the agency would end up doing with this kind of technology if they acquired it was setting up cameras at sensitive locations like churches or hospitals or schools, and then using those to almost randomly search people trying to access those vital services.
I understand there's also a concern about this technology giving false positives. What's that about?
So a false positive is when a recognition system looks at two images and says, yeah, these are the same people, but they're not actually the same people. And facial recognition technology to date has had a lot of problems, particularly when they're trying to match for people of color, which has some potentially pretty scary consequences if you consider this kind of technology being rolled out in, for instance, an immigration or law enforcement situation.
Have Amazon employees raised issues about, you know, their company being part of something like this?
Yes, and that's one of the really interesting things about Amazon's continued interest in working with ICE is that Amazon employees actually publicly came out with a letter saying, hey, we are very uncomfortable with recognition being sold to local police departments. We know from the emails we received that over a month later, ICE continued their discussion with Recognition.
Is there anywhere in the U.S. that's using Amazon's Recognition, which is the name of their facial recognition software?
So, yes, the ACLU earlier this year reported that a number of local police agencies had been using Recognition on sort of a trial basis. So this is technology that's already starting to be rolled out in the field. And unfortunately, at this point, we don't have as much information as we would like about how it's being used or what the implications of it are going to be for fairness of enforcement.
Andrea Peterson is with the nonprofit Project on Government Oversight. Thanks, Andrea.
Thanks so much for having me.
Voters in the Republic of Ireland went to the polls today. They were there to select a president, a largely ceremonial post in Ireland, and they voted in a referendum on a proposal to amend the country's constitution. Patsy McGarry is religious affairs correspondent for the Irish Times. Patsy, what's the issue?
Well, we have a provision in our constitution which was voted for the people in 1937, which bans blasphemy.
Blasphemy. So define blasphemy.
Well, that's a very, very difficult thing to do. It has never been properly defined in Irish law. And really, it's been inherited from the Victorian Westminster system. It was banned by common law in Ireland when we were ruled by Britain. And in fact, the last action in Ireland, the last, well, seemingly almost successful one, was in 1855. When a Catholic priest burned what he believed were bad books and accidentally included a Protestant Bible. And there was a complaint by a local Methodist minister. And the priest apologized, saying he didn't realize the Bible was there. So it was thrown out of court. The last successful action in Ireland, actually, on blasphemy grounds, was in 1705.
Wow.
When the Unitarian minister was jailed because he said Jesus Christ wasn't divine. He was jailed for a year and fined £1,000, which is quite a lot of money back then.
Yeah. Now, I understand there was some case involving Stephen Fry, the British comedian. I guess he got in a little trouble after he made some comments like these on Irish TV.
Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain?
I understand a citizen filed a complaint about that program, right?
Yeah, well, that interview was done in 2015, and Stephen Fry, who doesn't believe in God, was extraordinarily angry about that God, doesn't believe in on that program, which was 2 years later before there was a complaint on the grounds of blasphemy against that program, and our police set about looking for people who were outraged by it to sustain the allegation or the charge. They couldn't find anybody, and it ran into the sand. Nothing happened.
And what's interesting about this is that this citizen actually contacted Stephen Fry directly.
He did after that to point out that the only reason he made the complaint was to show up how asinine the Irish law on blasphemy was. And Stephen Fry was charmed by this. He thought it a particularly Irish solution to a piece of law that had no effect.
Has there been much pushback? You know, anybody want to preserve the blasphemy clause?
There's been very little. I mean, all our churches have come out in statements in recent days saying, indeed, this language has been the same, describing it as largely obsolete. And there have been some few predictable people who have said, no, we should preserve the blasphemy law. But they haven't really put up a very, very convincing case. Some people say that it may mean that religions could come under attack from all sorts of sides. But they are protected anyhow through incitement to hatred acts in this country, in the Constitution. So that really doesn't apply. And the belief is that the referendum today will be successful, as proposed by government, to remove the provision from the Constitution.
Patsy McGarry, the religious affairs correspondent for the Irish Times. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome, Carol.
Brazilians here in the U.S. are eligible to vote in their country's presidential runoff on Sunday. We hear how they're feeling about it ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Brazilians head to the polls this weekend to vote in a presidential runoff. And many Brazilians here in the U.S. are eligible to vote as well. The frontrunner, Jair Bolsonaro, has run a divisive campaign, but he has many supporters among Brazilians in Boston and other New England cities. Here's more from WGBH's Philip Martin.
WSRO AM in Framingham, Massachusetts, bills itself as America's only 24-hour Portuguese language station, and the Brazilian election dominates the airwaves.
Pois é, amigos, e o estatuto do desarmamento em função do que prega Bolsonaro.
The announcer says he's never seen a candidate that's generated as much fear and awe as Bolsonaro, the man who won 46% of the vote in the first runoff election this month. Bolsonaro's a right-wing former military man. Some Brazilian journalists have dubbed the Trump of the tropics.
Porque ele na realidade...
Another WSRO announcer, the Reverend Fernando Siqueira, openly supports Bolsonaro, like many other Brazilian evangelicals.
Now is time to change. Bolsonaro is bringing this new idea in the Brazil community here in Framingham. I know one to Bolsonaro.
At the entrance to a Brazilian bakery, Brazilians are walking out with beijinhos and loaded with opinions about the election.
It's coming towards Bolsonaro, put it this way.
Bolsonaro or Haddad?
Haddad.
Bolsonaro.
Por quê?
It's just because we need something extraordinary, like something different right now to make a difference.
Extraordinary is indeed how many supporters describe Bolsonaro. Others use the term extremist for a man who openly disparaged gays and blacks and insulted women. But when proof of past remarks is presented to these Bolsonaro supporters, some respond with a familiar refrain.
Fake news. Is no true.
Fake news.
Fake news.
Yeah. I think they lie about him.
That's all media. They're just trying not to get him elected, which is not going to happen.
Brazilians around the world can vote back home as long as they were born in Brazil, regardless of immigration status where they live. Most Brazilians in Massachusetts come from two relatively politically conservative areas in Brazil, Minas Gerais and Espírito Santo. And just as in those areas in Brazil, a clear majority of Brazilians here cast votes in the primary earlier this month for Bolsonaro.
Mr. Bolsonaro is tapping on the big pocket of resentment about corruption and also what we call cultural wars.
Marcelo Leite is a columnist for the newspaper Folio in Sao Paulo. He says Bolsonaro is exploiting resentment over Brazilian government programs for the poor. And that appeals to many Brazilian immigrants here in the U.S. because they see themselves as self-made.
Many immigrants working very hard to make a living think that having a government that's very much in favor of giving help to the poor people and this kind of thing is a waste. They would vote for minimum government. This kind of ideology is very widespread among Brazilian immigrants in the U.S.
They are resentful of the poor in Brazil.
Natalisa Tracy is executive director of the Brazilian Workers Center in Boston, where some of her clients face possible deportation by the Trump administration. But they still plan to vote for Bolsonaro, who's been quoted as saying Haitian immigrants bring diseases to Brazil and that he wants them out of his country.
They tell me that Trump is the devil, right? And then they turn around and they say, we're voting for Bolsonaro. And I say, what's the difference between Donald Trump and, oh, it's very different. And I says, well, what about racism and discrimination and promoting violence? I mean, I don't understand why people are not able to see that the two people are very similar in the message and the ideology.
Tracy supports the Workers' Party candidate, Fernando Haddad, even though the former leader of Haddad's party, former President Lula da Silva, is behind bars for corruption.
I'm not for corruption either, but I'm also not for fascism. And I'm very afraid of the outcome of this election.
Tracy will crowd into a local high school with thousands of other Brazilians in the Boston area to vote Sunday. And she fears democracy itself is at stake.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what's going on here. We're getting ready for the election.
Meanwhile, in Framingham, WSRO radio station announcers are mapping out live coverage from voting sites in eastern Massachusetts. Reverend Siqueira predicts Brazilians here and in Rhode Island will mark the day with celebrations when their man, Bolsonaro, tops the ticket.
This guy is the extraordinary guy.
For the world, Philip Martin, Boston.
Voter turnout is key in any election. Some places, like Brazil, have mandatory voting laws. Here in the U.S., ahead of the midterms, there are concerns in some states about efforts to suppress voting. North Dakota, for example. That's where the Stand and Vote campaign comes in. It seeks to encourage turnout and voter registration among Native Americans. Actor Mark Ruffalo is part of the Stand and Vote campaign. Mark, you were part of the protests and sit-ins that went on in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which has since been constructed. What got you involved in that campaign?
these water issues as they pertain to fossil fuel extraction was something that I'd already been working on for years. Many of the people that I worked with in New York were Native people. And when Standing Rock was happening, I was invited to come and stand with my Native brothers and sisters to protect their water.
So now you've pivoted a bit, still working with Natives and getting out the vote. I know Stand and Vote is a campaign geared toward Native populations in the U.S., and a big part of it, it has to do with the Supreme Court upholding this North Dakota voter ID law. What does that law say?
It basically says that unless you have a street address on your ID in North Dakota, you aren't allowed to vote. Most of the people who live on reservations don't actually have a physical street address. They use P.O. boxes.
So now that the Supreme Court has upheld that law, what can people on reservations in North Dakota do coming up on the midterms, say?
You know, they can give them a general street address through the Native Council, through the Tribal Council in each reservation.
I'm just curious, you're an actor, and I just wondered, do you call on different strengths or talents in your activism than in your acting career?
This is a function that artists have historically performed, bring light to those issues that that are in the dark. And whether you're doing it on a stage with ideas of a playwright, you're doing it a movie, with the struggles of human beings and storytelling, or you're doing it directly in direct action, like standing at Standing Rock or Occupy Wall Street, or getting involved with a campaign or the fight against the war in Yemen. These are part of the functions of being an artist, and something that I put a lot of good faith in.
Mark Ruffalo is an actor and activist. He's involved with the Stand and Vote campaign, an effort to get the vote out among Native Americans in North Dakota. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you. I'm so happy to talk to you.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, the view from Germany of the American president calling himself a nationalist.
When I talk to people from our own far-right populist party, the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, even they don't like using the word nationalist or nationalism to describe themselves.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. No question what the big story of the day is today: the arrest of a Florida man in connection with those explosive devices that were mailed to prominent Democrats and CNN this week. One thing the intended recipients have in common: they were all critical in some way of President Trump and have all been on the receiving end of inflammatory remarks by the president. Today at the White House, though, a different message from Trump. He said he's committed to do everything in his power as president to stop political violence from taking root in America.
But a bottom line is that Americans must unify. And we must show the world that we are united together in peace and love and harmony as fellow American citizens.
Trump's call for unity today seems to contradict a lot of what he says at political rallies and on Twitter. He often uses those platforms to attack his opponents and the media. That's part of what makes this midterm election season seem especially tense and divisive, even by 2016 standards. And comments like this one by the president at one recent rally just add fuel to the fire.
You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay?
We wanted to find out how all this sounds from outside the U.S., so we reached out to a couple of observers. First up, Jefferson Chase, a reporter for Deutsche Welle in Berlin, Germany. Jefferson, the word nationalist has a history here, most recently as one half of the phrase white nationalist. But of course, it's also an extremely loaded word in Germany. How did Trump's boast that he's a nationalist go down in Germany?
I mean, most of the things that Trump says and does don't go down very well in Germany, to be quite honest. It might be of interest to American audience to know that when I talk to people from our own far-right populist party, the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, even they don't like using the word nationalist or nationalism to describe themselves.
And of course, in Germany, the word nationalist is just inexorably associated with Nazis, which was the Nationalist Socialist Party of Germany. We're also joined by Christos Michalidis. He writes for the Greek news site Protagon. He's speaking to us from Athens. Christos, how do Greeks react when they hear the president of the United States use the term nationalist?
Let's go to the beginning, when he was freshly elected. Whatever he said went down rather badly here in Greece. And everybody was saying, what is he talking about? How can the president of the United States of America speak like that? Now there are quite a few people who are beginning to speak openly in favor of him. And these people come not only from the Golden Dawn Party, which is our extreme right-wing party. It's many people call it a neo-Nazi party. Now they are repeating all these last days that Donald Trump is actually copying them because they kind of wanted to change their label, which was a neo-Nazi party, and they called themselves a nationalist party. And when they heard Donald Trump calling himself a nationalist, well, they come out openly and they say, you see, even the strongest president in the world currently is calling himself a nationalist.
So it sounds like from both of you, when President Trump uses the term nationalist, there's resonance in both of your countries in terms of the far-right parties, except obviously, Jefferson, you mentioned in Germany that even the far-right party there does not use the term nationalist. But Christos, I want to go to you for this next topic, which is the big story this week here in the U.S., the explosive devices being sent to prominent Democrats and along with CNN. And authorities have someone now in custody who they believe might be behind these bombings. But I want to know how you've been writing about this big U.S. story. What's your take on it?
I think that in what we call here in Athens, the more intellectual side of the press, and the more democratic and the more pro-European, they seem to agree that these parcel bombs haven't ended up where they have just by luck. All the articles seem to agree that this was ignited by the rhetoric of President Trump, the way that he has been dealing with the press. He doesn't have almost any respect at all. He believes, as we think here in Athens and in Greece, that if you disagree with him on anything, you are immediately branded as a personal enemy. I must tell you that some of the Greek presses actually have actually hired some very eminent psychologists who, whenever Donald Trump says something, they actually analyze him in a psychological way.
Christos, I know Greece experienced its own parcel bomb episode. What happened there?
It was a few years ago, and those parcel bombs were sent by a terrorist group here in Greece, which took responsibility for these specific actions. I mean, they came out very openly and they said, we regard this person as being an enemy of the left-wing revolutionary struggle, and therefore we have targeted him. But what I've read in the press today in Athens, they draw no parallel lines between this story that we had in Greece and the one that is still developing in the States.
Jefferson, I want to come back to you for this final issue, which is about tapping phones and eavesdropping, something that German Chancellor Angela Merkel experienced herself. The news this week is that China and Russia have been routinely eavesdropping on President Trump's phone conversations. What are the parallels with what happened to Angela Merkel?
There certainly are some parallels. I mean, what's sort of different about the reporting is that with Merkel, it was almost like, how could our good friends and allies be doing this to us? If you talk to people off the record, you know, not on camera, they would say, yeah, we all know that this sort of stuff goes on all the time. We know that all major countries eavesdrop and spy on one another, but they shouldn't be doing it in such open and crass ways. That seems to have gotten a bit lost here. You know, it's sort of being more reported on as, well, you know, this is just another sign that Trump doesn't know what he's doing. that he's reckless, that he's endangering the security of everybody. It hasn't generated nearly as much heat as, say, the letter bomb story, which is the reaction that Christoph described in Greece, is exactly the same reaction that's happened here, where they're saying, you know, Trump has brought this on himself. He's ratcheted up the tension. That's generating a lot more passion, a lot more heat than the thought that someone's hacked Donald Trump's iPhone.
Now, I can't have a journalist from Germany and a journalist from Greece in an interview without asking you both. You know, your two countries have had some tensions in recent years, you know, over austerity and that kind of thing. I mean, how are your countries getting along these days?
Yeah. We should start.
Well, I think it's turned into a love affair slowly, slowly. Let's start from our prime minister, Mr. Tsipras, who was elected in 2015 with tens and thousands of people gathering in the center of Athens and repeating after him his very famous chant, Madame Merkel, go home. He hated her. And at the beginning, this kind of relation between Merkel and Tsipras was always at the core of our attention as journalists. How is he possibly going to confront her when he first meets her in the European Union? Gradually, we learned that a quite special relationship began between them. It was not, of course, a love affair by any terms, but it was certainly a kind of a mother towards a child affair. She seemed to kind of educate him in a way. Listen, let's talk peacefully. Come here, come to this room. Let's sit by ourselves sometimes and let's talk. We know now that he respects her very, very much. The situation, the relationship between the two countries, I think is quite good.
Jefferson, how does it feel in Berlin?
Yeah, I would pretty much agree with that. I mean, I think Greece is a lot smaller than Germany, so it doesn't command our attention here probably as much as we command their attention there. But I think the sense is that, you know, the Greeks have done a pretty good job of trying to get their economic problems under control. They've basically done what the Germans have asked of them, and that they should be given a break. And of course, you know, Angela Merkel has much bigger problems with some other European leaders, you know, I mean, compared to like Viktor Orban in Hungary, you know, going out for a meal with the prime minister of Greece is probably a walk in the park.
If I may just add another fact, I'm sure that Jefferson knows about that as well. We lost from a German, my favorite football team just lost from Bayern Munich 3 days ago, and I'm very, very disappointed about that.
I tactfully didn't bring that up.
Our team cost 8 million euros, and Bayern Munich, I heard, cost 800 million. So that's the difference.
Journalist Christos Michalidis is in Athens. Jefferson Chase is with Deutsche Welle in Berlin. I want to thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Happy to.
Our next story is about a part of immigrant life in the U.S. that sometimes goes unnoticed. It's the fact that immigrant workers are more educated than ever before. They're just as likely to hold a bachelor's degree as U.S. citizens. But often that education doesn't cross over, which prevents people from continuing the careers they had back home. Reporter Ashley Cleek noticed this imbalance in the nursing world, where there's a labor shortage, but she also found programs trying to bridge the gap.
Francinez St. Louis Defense was working as a nurse in Haiti when the massive earthquake struck in 2010. She rushed to care for women. She delivered babies.
I took care of people with HIV too, mother with HIV, taking care of the babies too.
Defense had found her calling. But in 2016, she moved to New York to be with her husband. She left her country and her career behind. Because to be a nurse in the U.S., you have to be certified here. It makes sense, but it also means that despite 8 years as a nurse in Haiti, Defense had to start over.
I could not work as a nurse, so I started working as an aide, health aide.
A home health aide, helping people with their meds, food, doctor's visits.
Types of basic stuff, so it's not anything related to nursing.
For Defense to be a nurse again, she needed to pass the certification exam, called the NCLEX. Most nurses educated in the U.S. nail it on their first try, but only 40% of immigrant nurses educated abroad make it through. Defense tried studying on her own, but the material and the language barrier overwhelmed her. Then she heard about a program at LaGuardia Community College in New York to help immigrant nurses like her prep for the test. The program's tough. 6 hours a day, 4 days a week, for 8 months.
Asterixis. Does anybody remember what that means?
On a recent evening, about 15 women from all over the world, Haiti, Nepal, Honduras, China, sit with their prep books with paragraphs highlighted in pink and yellow. Tonight's lesson is on kidney failure.
Following completion of dialysis, what would you expect the client to exhibit?
A.
Weight loss, right?
Instructor Phil Gimber moves through the answers, while another instructor writes out difficult words like creatine, ketones, and diluted on a long sheet of butcher paper. Some of the women are tired. It's late. Many have families and other jobs. Tanya Ramirez, who works with the program, says many of the students are like DeFonce, underemployed.
If they are working, they're working minimum wage jobs where they have to sit on the sidelines and basically not use any of their skills and know-how.
It's know-how the U.S. needs. At least 1 million more nurses will be in demand over the next few years to care for aging Americans. And the immigrant nurses coming out of this class are doing really well on that big certification exam with a 75% pass rate. And that motivated DeFonce to stick with it.
If people before you made it, they passed the exam, they come from other country, they do a lot of sacrifice, they make, you can do that too. They're not supernatural people.
But it's been hard for DeFonce. When she got into the test prep program, her husband was stationed at an army base in Florida. DeFonce knew she'd need to work weekends and study during the week, and that she couldn't do that while also caring for her baby daughter. So she sent her daughter to stay with her grandma in Haiti while she studied for the test.
I sacrificed my family to be able to finish the program.
She did finish the program and pass the NCLEX exam. She's a nurse in the U.S. But there's a hitch. To work at a hospital in New York, DeFonce is required to have a bachelor's degree, too. DeFonce has 4.5 years of college, 3 years of nursing school, and a year plus of midwife training. But the U.S. doesn't count the midwife part.
So they not consider all my studies together. So they just consider my nursing school. So I have to complete again for my bachelor degree.
So she signed up for college, part-time. She should finish in about 5 years. But at least with the nursing exam out of the way, DeFonce has brought her daughter back from Haiti. The family's all together now. After work one Saturday, DeFonce's husband makes a huge pot of stew. Their daughter rides a pink bike up and down the hallway. DeFonce is pretty tired. She's finished a long shift at a dialysis lab and still has classwork to do for her degree. But she says she's thinking of 5 years from now, when she'll be working in a hospital as a nurse. For The World, Ashley Gleick, New York.
That story is part of our Brain Gain series on immigrants and education. For more stories, just go to theworld.org/braingain. There's a controversy right now in Portugal involving fado, the musical tradition that dates back to the early 19th century. Fado tunes are usually about longing and loss, and they're played in all kinds of venues, including pubs, clubs, and cafes. One fado musician in Lisbon has been performing for the LGBT community there, and some fado purists are pushing back, as Catarina Fernandez-Martins reports.
Tiago Lila first fell in love with fado because of Amália Rodrigues.
No mercado da Ribeira há um romance de amor entre a Rita que é peixeira e o Chico que é pescador.
She put a name on a lot of things that I felt that didn't have a name or that didn't have an existence. They were just very dark, loose demons in my head.
As a teenager, he felt bullied in school and unsupported by his family. When he was 31, Tiago decided to study fado. But the fado school didn't know what to make of him.
I wanted to sing a song which the teacher said that only women could sing it. And I said, no, but I want to sing it. It's a song that I love. And he said, okay, but there is this verse which would translate as the man of my dreams, that you cannot change the verse. I stood up when the people were kind of laughing, and I said, but can I not have a man of my dreams?
Tiago quit the school, but he couldn't quit fado.
The first time that I sang with the Portuguese guitar and the classic guitar, I felt like almost like a spiritual experience. And I left the place and I walked home and I was shaking the whole time. It was really strong.
He still had to figure out how fado could include his identity as a gay man who didn't want to hide anymore. One night, watching a drag performance at a Lisbon bar, Tiago got an idea.
I asked this friend, this drag performer, he went with me to buy makeup and to buy clothes and to buy lots of other things. And then on the day he did my makeup, and then I was there and I was doing drag and singing fado for the first time.
And he began performing under the stage name Lila Fadista. Then he met João Caçador, who plays guitar, and they've been performing together as Fado Bicha for about a year now. They use an electric guitar instead of the traditional Portuguese guitar. And they rewrote classic lyrics about love and loss between men and women to tell the stories of LGBT love and of women's oppression.
It's time to put the stockings. Yes, stockings.
On a Wednesday evening at the Pensão Amor, Lila Fadista and João are getting ready backstage.
Since I'm wearing a short dress tonight, I will wear three pairs of stockings and another one, net one.
Lila dyed her beard blue and wears a black frizzy wig. She says she wants to echo the origins of fado, born among prostitutes, sailors, and drunks who lived on the fringes of society. If you know the song O Namorico da Rita, Rita's Love Affair, you might not recognize Fado Bicha's version, André's Love Affair. It's not just a gender swap. Fado performers sing standing still, their chins held high. But when Lila Fadista sings, she moans. She lies on the floor and teases the audience with sexual innuendo. Sitting in the front row, Marco Freitas likes what he sees.
Is this fado for you?
For me, this is fado. This is fado. And who else says this is not fado doesn't know what fado is.
But when Tiago and João gave their first concerts, they were criticized on social media by traditional fado singers. And the hate didn't stop there.
What I didn't expect was that we would have also some hate comments from LGBT people, specifically gay men and gay men who do drag, but older people, like 50-year-old, 60-year-old. And they used the same terms that the other people were using. So, freak, you should be ashamed of yourselves.
Outside social media, the disapproval is more subtle. João Caçador still plays guitar and sings fado in traditional houses. He says the other performers are friendly on the surface.
I think the most part of them, they know, but they never speak with me about it. It's like a taboo. Yeah. It's like the American quote, don't ask, don't tell. Something like that. Yeah.
That's Claudia Picado singing. She has never seen a Fado Bicha show, but she's not sure Fado Bicha constitutes real fado. Maybe if she closes her eyes, she says, slightly embarrassed. When she hears that Fado Bicha changed the lyrics of Namorico da Rita, she can't hide her bewilderment.
I prefer to see like a joke, because it is a joke, you know? Because if they want to record, it's not allowed. Because the poet write like in one way, it's not possible to change.
But Fado Bicha sees it differently. Especially since some of the poets who wrote iconic fado songs were gay at a time when they could face persecution.
We feel that it's legitimate from our part to sing these songs in a way, or to believe that it can be possible that we are giving voice to an undertext that was there the whole time but was never fully outed.
Tiago says Fado Bicho is about fado and art as much as it is about politics and activism. And he is convinced Amália Rodrigues would approve.
I think she would love it. I think if I had the opportunity to have a very quiet conversation with her, drinking a cup of tea and explaining to her how my life was, the impact that she had in my life growing up as a teenager, and how I channeled that through Fado Bicho, I think that she would be our number one fan.
For the World, Catarina Fernandes Martins, Lisbon.
From Lisbon back to Boston, that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have a great weekend. We're back with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.